Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hello and thanks for being with us again for another episode of Democracy Sausage, which comes to you twice weekly, actually, from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute, the Crawford School of Public Policy and the School of Politics and International Relations. I'm Mark Kenny, and it's my pleasure to welcome back Peter Martin, AM, because this episode we're going to delve into some interesting new thinking about the Australian economy. An economist, a broadcaster, a journalist, and now business and economy editor at The Conversation, Peter is also a visiting fellow at the aforementioned Crawford School here at ANU. Welcome back, Peter.
G'day, Mark. When we say welcome back, we should make the point for disclosure that we used to work in un-COVID-safe proximity to each other about 2 years ago when you were the chief political correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and I was the economics editor of The Age. So it's definitely a welcome back.
It is, and in fact, we've had you on the podcast a few times since then, and it's always good to have you because I've always regarded you as not just a very good economist, but also a very good communicator of economics, and that's
well,
just such
there
a critical
should be events thing. In your things. Can I say that? Is that right? Yeah, go for it.
that's
in
right.
The discussions we would have in the pressure cooker environment, this is the thing, you see, people who say, newspapers, got this wrong or that wrong, I don't think they realise the miracle that the production of stuff in real time before 6 p.m. or whenever it is, we were both sort of honoured to be part of that.
Well, I absolutely agree, and particularly so in the advent of the digital age when you've effectively got rolling deadlines. So you've got news going out contemporaneous with events.
And even the print deadlines, in some newspapers they used to be 11 p.m., The Age used to have a 1 a.m. edition. Oddly, technology has brought them forward so that people – have to, and the events tend to happen, as we've seen with events this week, tend to happen, late in the afternoon.
Mm.
And the ability, of course, terror does it, the ability to quickly synthesise stuff and on the whole get it right is remarkable.
But, yes, and if you don't get it right, then perhaps change it as soon as you realise that you haven't.
Bit hard in the days of printed papers, though.
And also I think that's true, but I also think that it's interesting as a commentator, as I was so much, doing so much analysis on a daily basis.
Real-time analysis, yeah. Which is the hard thing.
It is hard because you have to make judgments about whether a given stunt or statement by the Prime Minister or opposition leader, whatever it might be, is consistent, whether it works, whether it was ill thought through or not. You make some judgments about it, and the next day or later that day you will see your contemporaries from the other mastheads opining on it as well. And I'd be lying if I didn't say there were some times where I didn't think, that's a better take on it than mine, or whether you were sweating overnight,
thinking, should I have said that? Is everyone else going to say that something that I've missed out? I would be lying.
But there are times when you're on the upside of that as well, where you just – and we were just talking before we pressed record here, we were just talking about budget lockups, for example. You know, you go into the budget lockup and you pour through these massive documents and you have to make some judgments about it. I used to write often the splash story and a lead commentary piece. And you don't really have enough time to talk to anyone else. You don't have access to too many people. And to the extent that you do, you really are just up against the sheer quantity of words you have to churn out. So, yeah, you do spend a lot of time that night worrying about whether you've gone hard enough or gone too hard or whatever it might be. And I remember that budget back in 2013-14.
The first hockey budget, the first Abbott budget, which was the one that we had to make a judgment on. I made the wrong judgment, I think. I thought it was good. They're cutting back on the growth in the pension and so on. This is all good. And it was certainly wrong as far as the public judgment went. But we only knew that, the next day when everyone said, you can't do that.
Well, you know why I mentioned it, of course, because I think I got it right. that's just good. Human psychology. What I saw in it was the quite proud statement that they were cutting $80 billion out of health and education. And I remember saying to the editor at the time, this is the lead. This is the lead right here.
You were right.
I don't think anyone else led with that.
No, and one of the reasons they didn't we'll get to the economy, which is what we're going to talk about. One of the reasons they didn't in that budget is if you look through all of the budget papers, which is what the wonks, which is what the economics writers, what I did, right? You look through the budget papers, that figure wasn't there. We have cut $80 billion from health, education and welfare. It was in what we call the glossy, which is a sort of it's like a real estate brochure.
It is.
It was in that.
It's a pricey of the budget and usually a positive spin on it too.
That's right. And, well, they thought it was positive. It's directed at, a general audience who is too, non-specialised to bother with the budget documents. Well, of course, all of us wonky people, right, myself, Ross Gittins, Tim Kolbatch, all of these people, we didn't read the glossy. That's why we missed it.
Yeah, well, that's possibly true. Whereas I had to write the front page and I had to get it done quite quickly. So I needed to say,
serious retail communication. You used the retail document and that happened to be where the story was.
I did look at the other documents too.
It was your own brilliance too.
I look at the other documents too, or I turn to my economics editor who's sitting next to me.
So what does this mean?
Yeah, is this for real? Now, we touched last week on the podcast on Ross Garnaut's latest book, Reset, in which he argues that we can use this historic moment to make long-needed changes for the better. The logic of this is pretty sound. It's a matter of political will, right? So almost a year ago as the pandemic took hold, and I'm going to quote Aaron Duddy Roy here because I can see a look of puzzle on your face, Peter. I'm going to quote Aaron Duddy Roy here because she wrote a spectacular essay for the Financial Times way back in April of last year, excoriating governments, particularly the far-right Hindu nationalist Modi government, for its handling of the crisis in the beginning and for what that crisis showed. Now, I can still see this puzzle on your face, but let me just roll this out and I think then it will become clear. She said that that pandemics historically forced humans to break with the past and to imagine a world anew. Quote, "This one is no different. It's a portal, a gateway between one world and the next. We can choose to walk through it, dragging our carcasses of our prejudice and hatred, our avarice, our data banks and dead ideas, our dead rivers and smoky skies behind us. Or we can walk through lightly with little luggage, ready to imagine another world." I just think it's such a fantastic summation of the hinge point that we are at with our economy now. And I raise it because you've written a piece that is a bit more specific. It's about the Australian economy and it's about what Josh Frydenberg might do now, what the government might do now as led by the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg. And so I just wanted to sort of use that 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 idea that we are at least blessed with the opportunity of imagining Australia afresh, looking in a whole range of areas. We could look at climate change, for example. The world's changing on that right now. And we could look at, for example, long-standing problems in the budget and use this moment to address them. And that's what you've done with this piece that you've written for The Conversation, talking about what Josh Frydenberg can do. One of the things you say, I suppose it's the key argument you say, is that he can drive a stake through the heart of unemployment.
He can kill it, and it has happened before. Now, as Roy said, and as I observe, these moments happen rarely. In Australia, the last moment we had was about 30 years ago, with the early 90s recession. When they do, everything is open. And I was thinking about the quote you read, and what would have been unthinkable? The kind of lockdowns that we saw in Victoria. The Reserve Bank governor addressed the National Press Club earlier this year and said he was in, I've forgotten which country it was, I think it might have been Canada, for some international meeting when China locked down all of its citizens where the coronavirus was. And he was wondering, could that ever happen in a democracy? Okay, that's how much things have changed. Mm. We've been trying forever to cure cancer. We've been trying forever to cure, maybe we haven't been trying hard enough, but to cure the various diseases of aging. We've been trying forever, maybe with not that much seriousness, to get a vaccine against a coronavirus. We'd never done it. We did it in 6 months.
Mm.
So
yeah, it's extraordinary.
These moments, I mean, the trite cliche is never waste a crisis,
yeah.
But it's in a crisis that the previously unthinkable gets put on the table. And just a really minor instance is that we now have an increase in Newstart, which is now called JobSeeker, okay? Mm. That was previously impossible.
And
all people are worrying about now, and you know, fair enough, is the quantum. They're not remembering that a year before, that just wasn't something anyone
was. It was off the table,
yeah. Yeah.
And in fact, the last election, neither side took an increase to the dole to the election.
Well, Labor was took a promise to investigate the matter the election.
That's right. And I sort of had a habit of asking treasurers at the post-budget lunch why they'd not done anything about unemployment, just because I wanted to establish a kind of a, you know, consistent question and get both sides to address it. And in both cases, you got kind of vague statements. The best form of welfare is a job, which is the standard, you know, line you get from the government. You got the kinds of, as you say, the kind of vague promise to look at this when we're in government from the opposition, because it was said to be too expensive, and presumably there wasn't the, you know, the political payoff, the political dividend there.
And you do things as you have done them before.
Yeah.
Also partly in Australian politics, because you're not going to be in office 10 years down the track to get a payoff for a big change. It's just going to be work, really, and, you know, create losers as well as winners. Now, this is what happened 30 years ago.
So this is Bernie Fraser.
Head of the Reserve Bank. Keating's mate, well, Keating no longer thought he was his mate after this, and it contributed to Keating losing the election in 96 to John Howard. We were coming out of recession. Recession had, of course, pushed up unemployment, as you expect, and killed inflation, temporarily dulled inflation. You know, I think prices were falling. They weren't rising. Inflation had been throughout the previous decade as high as 10%, as high as 8%. We find that hard to believe now, and that's the point.
Yeah.
What Fraser did, this is recorded in various sort of recollections of people at the time, he explained to board members of the Reserve Bank that having gone so far, having created this, if you like, scorched earth and, among other things, destroyed inflation, he was not going to take his foot off its throat. That is to say, he was going to finish the job and kill inflation forever. And what he did, when inflation started to rise, 93 it started to rise, and in 94, in one of the months in 94, he without warning, really, increased interest rates by 0.75%. We wouldn't believe that now.
No, right? That's 75 basis points. We did see a couple of movements of that magnitude and a bit higher in the GFC, but generally you don't do it.
And then in October, a few months later, he increased them by 100 basis points, by another percent. And then in November, he increased them by another 100 points. In other words, he was determined, in that case, at a cost to jobs, at a cost of recovery, that he was going to get something out of this which is going to destroy inflation forever. He did that high unemployment at the time was unpopular. Paul Keating lost the election. By the time inflation was dead, early in John Howard's term, he could enjoy continued falls in interest rates. But inflation has never again been anywhere like what it was. He took advantage of that opportunity to salvage something. That was then, 30 years ago.
Yeah, so that and I think Keating used the term at the time, we've broken the inflation stick, I think he used to say.
I might have. It was his successor, Peter Costello, who referred to killing the inflation dragon. The inflation dragon is dead. Now, that was unpleasant at the time. It certainly involved a change from orthodoxy, putting up interest rates in a recovery. But if you think of the long-term benefits, nowadays, and yeah, people expect modest wage rises each year and they expect prices to go up a bit each year, but these days no one expects rapid inflation, which does cause problems. You know, in the Whitlam era, it approached 20%. Now, that's a sort of problem. And it was 10% and thereabouts in the 80s. So he achieved something lasting forever. I'm saying that the present treasurer, Peter Costello, Josh Frydenberg, not through anything other than circumstance, is presented with another opportunity, not one he could have planned for.
Yeah, now you've, and that is in relation not to inflation in this case, but to unemployment. We can come to what is full employment and what and how that impacts on inflation, for example, wage inflation, other inflation. But let's just stick with Frydenberg for a sec just to set the scene. You say that he does have – there are some signs in his past behaviour that he does have this reformist zeal within him.
He certainly does, with success. Now, people will argue about the success, but I'll set out three things, and they're trivial compared to breaking the back of unemployment, right, to permanently lowering unemployment. But he took on the tech giants and won. Now, people will say he didn't win against Facebook and Google. All I will say is that they are now more or less happily paying big amounts of money to news organisations and they weren't going to before. It's not the first time he's done that. We used to be able to get goods. We used to be able to get services from overseas, Netflix, Amazon services and so on, streaming services. And he introduced the Netflix tax. People told him that they would never pay it, of link to pieces where people say they'll never pay it.
So this is paying. This is Netflix
paying GST.
Yeah, collecting GST
and passing it on. Yeah. To level the playing field with Australian retailers. They did it. A few years later, he introduced it for parcels. These are things that Amazon delivers to your house, low-value parcels, less than $1,000, which most of the Amazon parcels are, were exempt from GST. Now, people said again, Amazon will never pay it. They're quietly paying it. He has taken on, in those cases, big tech and achieved what people thought was impossible, mainly by changing the debate, by asserting that something is possible, asserting that they'll do it, working the media, working other people, building a case until, if you look at what happened in the Facebook thing, the sort of final compromise, you know, where Facebook paid media organisations, we're reading it in the terms of the debate that Frydenberg set, which is not whether they should pay, but how they should pay. So he has shown a willingness to make history where he thinks it's needed. Nothing on the scale of what I and also Roscoe and I were talking about, though.
Right. Well, look, let's take a quick break and we'll come back to the detail of what you're talking about in terms of this unemployment thing.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, we were talking before about Josh Frydenberg and whether he's got the steel in his spine for this fight that you're advocating, and you're saying he can break the back of, or what was it, kill permanent long-term unemployment?
It is possible for him to foot his neck. He'd put his foot on the neck of unemployment in the same way as Bernie Fraser did with inflation. Now, to understand this, to get a sense of it, you need to be old, not quite old enough to be a subject of the Aged Care Royal Commission, but old. Up until the early 70s, up until 72, inflation in Australia averaged right through from the end of the Second World War, unemployment averaged 2%. Not 5, not 6, not 8, 2. That's over that entire period. There were various big changes that happened at that time. There were the oil crises and so on. We don't quite know why, but from then on, the sort of average rate, what people believed to be the floor, in fact, under unemployment, shot up. And unemployment averaged 6.8% for all of the decades that followed. That's a very big change. Now, when we had an unemployment rate of 2%, New Zealand had an unemployment rate of 1%. Now, there are people who say...
During a time when we had a fixed exchange rate?
We did. Yeah. Also, by the way, during a time when we had massive migration on a scale that you know, as a proportion of the population that we've never seen since, for those people who say that migrants push up unemployment, they certainly didn't do it then.
Mm-hmm.
So we had very low unemployment, and people don't always realise that there always has to be some unemployment. Now, I'm not trying to sound like Jesus here. The poor will always be with us. There always, though, has to be some unemployment. Reason is, you leave a job. You don't want to take the very first job that comes along. And even if you did, it might take a week or two to come along. You probably want to take the job that's right for you, that you'll make the most contribution that'll work for you. That might take 6 months. Now, we work out the unemployment rate by surveying people, and when the statistician comes along, these days it's online, asks you, have you searched for work in the last so many months? Have you worked? And you'll have to say, I have searched for work. I'm not in work, and you will be unemployed. So you can never get the unemployment rate down to zero. There's always what we would call frictional unemployment.
Yeah.
Now, the frictional unemployment was, up until the early 70s, regarded as very low, less than 2%, because unemployment averaged 2% then. We've come to regard it in the decades since, it's generally been regarded as 5%, that you can't get unemployment down below 5% for long, and we haven't.
Yes, I mean, this was pretty much the orthodoxy in political and economic journalism, as you'd often say, well,
the natural rate of unemployment.
Yeah, essentially, 5% unemployment is full employment.
That was the belief.
Yeah.
And you could get it below that, and we did briefly during the mining boom, but it was thought...
But it comes with risks when you do that,
right? Yeah, it comes with inflation risks because in order to actually fill the jobs, employers need to offer higher wages to persuade Mark to move after a week instead of after 6 months, right?
Right.
So that was regarded as stoking inflation. It'd be too hard. And 5% was adopted as the target. Until just before coronavirus, the Reserve Bank announced in November 2019 that its calculation suggested the there's a complicated acronym for it, which I won't use if you want to look it
up. Well, I was going to make a joke about going to Nauru rather than going to Nehru. Right.
What does it stand for?
It's the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment.
That's right. Yeah. So that's what people call the natural rate of unemployment or full employment, right? The Reserve Bank said its calculation suggested it had fallen, that the natural rate was 4.5%. Now, that's a lot lower than 5. And by the way, something we haven't achieved in about a decade. And even then, it was
And yet
temporary.
It's worth noting at this point that prior to the coronavirus crisis, the US was operating at, what, 3.5% unemployment?
Yeah, and what happened in the US was they too have been estimating the Nauru, right? Mm. And every time they've estimated it, they've got a lower unemployment rate, and then they've revised their estimate. They've got a lower, and it went down and down and down. It was 3.5%. It had been heading down, so it probably would have headed down further. 3.5%, not 5%, not 4.5%. Now,
is their measure is the same? I mean, it won't be identical to ours, but would you say it's any less reliable of their labour market?
It's not less reliable, but you've got to add a margin for the portion of the population they have in prison. So,
and what about undocumented?
I don't know about that. Mm. I do know that the effect of the imprisoned population is actually, I worked it out once, but it's actually significant. So that is to say, the US can have a certain unemployment rate, Australia can have a certain unemployment rate, but if you compare the proportion of the population of working age in work, which is, if you like, a truer measure because, you know, people who are in prison are neither employed nor unemployed, you'll find that Australia does better against the US than the unemployment figures suggest. Nonetheless, they got their figure down on any measure much lower than Australia. Now, what I am about to reveal is that Nauru, this rate, isn't good enough. And here's why. It's a slight mathematical argument. There's not too much to it. The acronym you just read, recited from memory.
The non-accelerating inflation rate.
Yeah, it's the non-accelerating inflation rate. Now, we need to accelerate inflation. Inflation is at the moment 0.9%. an annual basis. Wage growth is just 1.4% on an annual basis. We have targets. The target is the Reserve Bank and Treasurer have agreed on a target. Inflation should be between 2 and 3%, where it hasn't been for a while.
And the Reserve Bank should use monetary policy to the extent that it can.
Use that much now, but it can't cut interest rates much
further. That's the theory, isn't it? That its monetary policy decisions should be based on getting inflation within that band.
Yeah. And in this case, it will need help from government spending or tax cuts to do it. But we actually need to get wage growth back to where people feel comfortable. They don't feel comfortable with 1.4%, which, by the way, for many people means no wage rises for years, right? Mm, that's your average, right?
Now, this is a point Garneau's been making, actually, that if we don't do something about this soon, we are actually going to go past the last recession, I think it was the Great Depression, where we had stagnant wage growth for a length of time, and we're about to go past that length of time unless we start to get some genuine wage growth in the economy now.
And Garneau's making another important point related to that. One of the things, so Garneau says, you know, we need to boost the economy, partly because it's nice to boost the economy, partly because it'll help the government's finances, partly because it'll get people in jobs. He says two ways of doing it. One is to cut the unemployment rate big time. And the other is all of this messy stuff that no one likes, you know, structural reform, changing industries, you know, all of that upheaval and so on. We had a lot of it in the 80s when Ross Garneau was advising Bob Hawke. We cut tariffs, you know, we floated the dollar. We did all of those things. He is saying in his book that if you are to do that, you won't do it unless you can take the people with you. Yeah. You will be able to take them with you if they feel they can get jobs. But the mathematical point I was pointing out is sort of very important. So we need to accelerate inflation. In other words, we need to get the unemployment rate below Nauru, the natural rate, whatever you want to call it, below full employment. How low? Garneau in his book says 3.5%. But he makes this important point, which is the point in the US. We don't know how low. We need to keep doing everything we can to push unemployment down until we get inflation of the kind we used to have.
So when it starts to give inflation a bit of a tickle, we know we're at
the
floor.
No, then you can stop.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you get too much inflation, you can whack up interest rates a bit. That'll be the day.
Well, there's plenty of room to do that.
There certainly is.
The room's all in one direction.
Yeah. So he doesn't know how low. We do know that the economy has worked. It worked extremely well when the unemployment rate was 2%, right? We do know it worked in New Zealand when the unemployment rate was 1%. How would the government do that? As you suggested, the Reserve Bank can't do much. It can't lower its cash rate, which drives mortgage rates much further. Mind you, we said that when they cut it to 0.25% and they said that was as low as it was going.
They call that functional zero, don't they?
Well, they did call it functional zero, and then they cut it further to 0.1%, which is the new functional zero.
Yeah.
negative rates are being used overseas. The best way to do it is for the government to keep doing what it's doing. Now, that sounds like a trivial thing to say, but the government has promised not to keep doing what it's doing. It said in the budget, it has a budget strategy section that it's required to have, that when unemployment gets a bit below, or its words,
safely
exactly,
below
comfortably,
6%. Comfortably,
it's oh, comfortably, exact words,
right. Yeah.
Comfortably below 6%, it'll start tightening the budget, it'll start cutting back spending. Garneau believes this is a false economy. Because I just did one calculation. If unemployment fell from its present 6.8% to 4.5%, which is less than the fall I'm talking about, you would save $4 billion a year in Newstart. You'd have a whole lot of extra taxpayers, right? So his view is that you can shrink government debt as a proportion of GDP by ramping up GDP, getting people in jobs. It's good for them. It's good for us who buy their services. Listen to podcasts like this and so on. The funny thing is, Mark, you know, as I was writing those words, I sort of went back in time and I thought 20 years earlier I would have been writing that these people make the goods we use.
Mm.
Isn't that funny? Anyway, but, you know, our goods tend to be made overseas.
Yeah.
Certainly there are plenty of services, as the Aged Care Royal Commission pointed out, that can be provided. You know, it will be consumed by people here and will be provided by people here. So we need something very ambitious. That will mean either further big tax cuts, continued big spending without stopping, bigger government debt, certainly bigger government debt in absolute terms, for much longer. Now, that's a bold strategy.
Well, it's a strategy that...
By the way, it's a strategy other treasurers might have been loath to consider.
Yeah,
which it gets us back to what we're talking about.
Gets us back to about Frydenberg, because Frydenberg has done things even in this crisis. I guess all countries have been forced to do new things, but Australia's done new things that have been quite effective, unlike a whole number of other countries.
On a dime. So, you know, JobKeeper was invented.
Yeah, wage subsidies, just like
very,
that.
Very, very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, you know, it's going to employers who'd never needed it and so on. Fair enough. But... the point is that they knew it was going to be rough and ready, just like in the global financial crisis.
Yeah.
They knew some money was going to go to dead people or something, but that wasn't the point. And certainly this week's national accounts figures, which show yet another rebound in the economy, second quarter in a row after the recession, and the rebound being led by private spending, consumer spending, tends to show that what Frydenberg and the Treasury did in terms of forcing money into people's hands, people who would have otherwise been unemployed, a lot of them got a pay rise as a result of JobKeeper to start with, and you know, doubling other payments, government payments, has actually worked in that it's led to people spending. So that was bold, that was quick, and I'm pretty sure that when the Reserve Bank suggested it to him, given the pressure of time to do something, he didn't blink.
Yeah. Now, what do you think Philip Lowe, the governor of the Reserve Bank, what do you think he thinks? Because I know our old colleague Ross Gittins wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago trying to sort of read between the lines of what Philip Lowe says to kind of understand, you know, what's he not saying that indicates a certain position. He's made some observations about the NERU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, saying that he doesn't believe that anything above 4.5% is likely to add to inflation. Are we to infer from that that he's in the same school of thought or train of thought that you and others are now advocating, that we can in fact drive unemployment down lower before we get to other problems showing up in the economy?
His former words, we had a chat at the National Press Club after his address, and his form of words was not that, you know, 4.5% is where you'll get inflation. His form of words was anything above 4.5%, you've no risk of an increase in inflation. That suggests he thinks it should be much lower. Now, we don't know what went on inside the Reserve Bank. I do know that when they do calculations like this, they produce a range of estimates. Mm-hmm. You would not expect a single point estimate, and that the Reserve Bank has published one of them. I think it's likely that there are some estimates floating around inside the Reserve Bank suggesting something lower than 4.5%. You'd expect so. But the key point is we won't know until we try. Everything suggests that the Reserve Bank Governor Phil Lowe and Ross Garnaut, former government advisor, are on the same page. I think they both want if you think about his sort of employment contract, the governor of the Reserve Bank has been told in a written agreement, you know, signed by the treasurer and him, to get inflation to between 2% and 3%. Now,
so he's almost got a responsibility to do something to dish it up at the moment.
He runs a risk of leaving office with inflation never having been in the center
high enough to get into the band.
Yeah. So if you think of, if you like, the incentives on him, but he is not that kind of person. He is everyone who's had anything to do with him describes him in extremely good terms as a human being. His concern is that we can get far more out of the economy than we are. Now, his toolbox, it's the toolbox of the cash rate, is exhausted. He has other things he can do. And what Garnaut has suggested is that the government spends this extra money, these extra hundreds of billions of dollars, keeps doing it. And as I said, the spending can be two-way. It could be tax cuts, could be spending. It doesn't really matter. It funds it directly from the Reserve Bank. This hasn't happened before. What's happened before is we've had this fig leaf where the government has sold bonds to the private market, which are private banks, and then the Reserve Bank has bought it from them.
So that's what they call the secondary market. So they're buying government bonds on the secondary market. And
that's right.
You're now proposing that perhaps they could, or maybe
Garnaut's proposing that they buy it directly.
Primarily.
And the reason for cutting out the middle person is that when private buyers buy it, it pushes up the value of the Australian dollar. And our dollar is going scarily high, really, if you're concerned about being competitive. Our dollar's going up to 80 cents where it hasn't been for ages. Problem is, you see, that every other country is doing the kind of things that Garnaut's suggesting. Now, that means not every country can devalue, can become more competitive at once, you know. The entire globe can only devalue against another planet, right? It can't. So that's another reason for us aggressively spending, because we can't cut the rates that matter, aggressively spending, funded by the Reserve Bank, until we get inflation. And that'll have a very big secondary benefit in that a lower dollar makes our goods competitive. Now, this is a bit of a fool's errand to try and get competitive, because, as I said, every other country is trying it. But we'd be not doing ourselves a service if we were one of the countries left with a high exchange rate, because people would buy their things from elsewhere.
All right, a final question. It's a bit of a double barrel one. Again, Philip Lowe and reading between the lines, or the hints he occasionally uses, he has actually hinted in the past that workers should perhaps get a bit more bolshy, should get a bit more demanding. They ought to sort of ask for higher pay, because he's obviously very conscious, as you would expect, about that low wage inflation, low wage growth, that it is a problem. But, of course, you've got a lot of insecurity in the labour market.
Yeah,
there's a lot of insecurity everywhere.
You won't have that if there are jobs going everywhere.
Yeah.
So, I will feel better.
That's the politics of it. Let's go to Frydenberg then. You've made the point that he's done some imaginative things. We've seen some very influential treasurers in our time, Keating and Costello, for example, commanding presences within their respective governments. Is Frydenberg a commanding presence within the Morrison government, or does he have the makings of a treasurer that could be that influential figure? What's your assessment of that? And can he bring the party room with him?
Well, you can give me yours as a political observer. In my view, he is one of, if not the most impressive people in the parliament.
Mm.
Now, that may not be the highest bar that there is, right? But nonetheless, it's the case. He's a future leader. He has the opportunity now. Certainly, he has what it takes. He wouldn't have had the opportunity without a crisis, right?
Yeah.
No one would have listened to the Treasury suggesting something like this without a crisis. He has the opportunity, though, as Treasurer, to do something bigger. That is something for which he will be remembered longer. If he is the person who cuts unemployment from the sixes that it's been in to something way less than five, this will be a turning point remembered, as the early 70s is remembered, as a time when unemployment shot up and never went down. He will have been seen, just as among people who follow this closely, the Reserve Bank governor at the time, Bernie Fraser, is seen as the person who killed inflation. He will be seen as the person who killed unemployment. Now, that's a rather better thing, in my view. I'd rather that on my tombstone than he served a term or two as prime minister. So this is an opportunity which is still there, okay? It hasn't gone away. It will go away when we get back to normal. I think the minute the government starts tightening the budget again.
Mm.
Now, what it is said in those budget documents is it'll start doing it when it's comfortably below 6%. I'm told that the word comfortably has a lot of wriggle room, but if they actually start doing it, then we'll know the moment has passed and that we will live with an unemployment rate scarcely ever lower than 5% for the foreseeable future, till 30 years' time, whatever, when there's another crisis. Until that window closes, there's the opportunity for them to keep the budget deficit big, to keep borrowing, in the certainty that if they do it enough, there are going to be so many people working, Australia's going to be such a better place that the debt won't be that bad. But the opportunity is open at the moment.
And you don't imagine you'd see much in the way of austerity between now and whenever the election is anyway?
No, well, a budget is very soon, of course. Mm-hmm. The budget's in May. Yeah. We're now in March.
And there's talk there'll be two budgets between now and the election. I mean, we don't know that,
well,
of course.
Well, I think there could be. You
would have to be an early one next year, but it's possible.
But my guess is, I don't know your guess, that There won't be an early election this year.
That's my guess. Yeah, things aren't going so well at the moment.
Yeah, so that, and I think you're right. I think that we won't see austerity before the election. So that holds the window open a bit longer. But what the Treasurer can do, same as the Reserve Bank Governor, the Reserve Bank calls it open mouth operations, is start talking about his intention, start talking about how he interprets comfortably below, start talking about the need to get unemployment well below what it used to be. And that will, if you like, as he did with those other things we're talking about, with the big tech things, that will open the door, open the conversation.
And frame the debate, yeah.
And that's what he, and not only in this, when he was energy and environment minister, anything like a carbon price was verboten in the coalition. He, with the help of the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, and others, but it was, you know, he did the work, designed the NEG, the National Energy Guarantee, which would have worked to both lower prices and lower emissions. And that was something that changed the debate. It happened to roll a Prime Minister. Turnbull lost his job. But that was another instance of it taking somewhere that a year before people would have thought, well, that can't happen. That's just not in the range of what's possible. Changing what's possible and then doing it. So is he the right person to do it? Yes. Is the time right? Absolutely. It comes along rarely. Will it happen? I don't know. It depends what he wants on his tombstone, I guess. Depends how bold he is.
Yeah, well, I guess.
It depends a lot on us. I mean, I think of my children. They'll have children soon. Do I want them to be in a world where everyone can get jobs, in a country where everyone can get jobs? Yes. Is that a country where the unemployment rate is 5%? No.
No.
It's sort of quite important as well, I think.
Right. So we're looking for a bit of strategic ambiguity, if nothing else, from Josh Frydenberg in the short term, with eyes on a pretty big reform prize, if you can get it right.
Yeah, he does it that at the least, but he tends to, if you look at those other things I mentioned, he tends to do more. He's very good at introducing things into the debate and changing the debate. And then people, on whatever it is, be it the level of job seeker, be it how much Facebook pays News Limited and other organisations, the end result by the time it happens is seen as, oh, yeah, that was in the range of what was expected. But when Frydenberg has done this in the past, he's delivered things which, in fact, were not in the range of what had been expected a few years earlier.
At the beginning of the process, Peter, it's been terrific talking these things through with you. Look forward to doing so again in the near future, probably if not before, certainly shortly after the budget. That would be terrific. Thank you for coming into Democracy Sausage again this time.
Great pleasure.
And thanks for listening. We'll be back with another Democracy Sausage early next week. Until then, bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.